Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast tonight, brought to you by our friends at Helix Sleep and Vistaprint. Danny, the playoffs still coming into somewhat clear focus, but I think the one game that was good tonight that I wanted to talk about that had a pretty significant effect on the East playoff race was Detroit and Miami. Reggie Jackson didn't play, and Miami was able to break contact down the stretch due to a great performance by Joe Johnson.
Yeah, Joe Johnson really came on down the stretch. Just the quick thing with this, with the kind of the impact is that Detroit losing settled the 7-8. We'll talk about the rest of it, but that part of it. But Joe Johnson, especially you would say down the stretch was really where he made his impact, right?
Yeah, he was fantastic. I think he had 16 in the fourth quarter, finished up with 25 points on 16 shooting possessions. They really just did not have an answer for him at all. It was Tobias Harris and Marcus Morris, really neither of them had much success guarding him. And Joe, is just, you got to give him credit. I mean, I think we both thought he was just about done the way he played the first 2 months of the year in Brooklyn, but quietly he came on starting in January. And then now in Miami, he's just been unbelievable since he arrived there. In 23 games, he's 32 minutes a game. The Heat are plus 7.7 per 100 with him on the floor. Only a 17% usage, so he's not really shooting too much, and taking the ball out of their playmakers, but 61% true shooting, shooting over 45% from three, and he is shooting 53% in the paint non-restricted area, where he gets a fair amount. He doesn't get all the way to the rim a lot, and then 55% on mid-range twos outside of the paint. That may not be sustainable necessarily. Certainly his 46% on above the break threes is not either, but he certainly is not done. He has been awesome and just a big part of why they've been able to keep it together without Chris Bosh. And then also he provides another score so they can move Luol Deng to the four and just get more overall shooting on the team.
And as we've discussed early in the season with Paul George, what you need to do when you're playing two kind of scoring forwards is if you have somebody that's good enough that you force them to make the choice, then you can actually get fours guarding Luol Deng, which is something that they didn't have to, teams didn't have to do that as much when they had Justice Winslow there.
Yeah, I agree with that. Another really interesting aspect of this game was the battle between Hassan Whiteside and Andre Drummond. They both shot pretty poorly. Whiteside 4 out of 10, Drummond 4 out of 11. Drummond was able to get 9 offensive rebounds on Whiteside, in part because Whiteside has a habit of going for the block a lot in pick and roll, leaving the defensive glass exposed. If he could kind of be a little bit more Tim Duncan style on the access, intimidating the guards, but not actually jumping for the shot, not getting out of position. And one thing that's been kind of making the rounds today with all the award picks going out is that the Heat actually give up more offensive rebounds when he's on the floor due to that propensity to chase blocks. And, he had some really maddening moments in this game. But, he also had 5 offensive rebounds of his own. He did have 3 blocks. Those do count when he gets them. And he had a huge offensive rebound down the stretch where they eventually got a 3 in that possession that kind of iced it. So it was a lot of good, bad side. Maybe that's what we can start calling him now. Good side or bad side based on how he plays. But, overall, I thought he was reasonably effective in this one.
Yeah, I thought he did a reasonably good job. And, of course, some of what you're looking at defensively is just kind of how your counterpart does. And as you said, Drummond was inefficient in this game. The kind of the matchup that I actually was most intrigued by was not there. It was Dwayne Wade, KCP.
Yeah, Wade was 6 out of 16, started very slowly, and then he had a brief flurry at the end of the first half. He was able to get into the post a little bit in the second half, but Miami actually made their big run. Wade played 34 minutes. When Wade went out midway through the fourth quarter or so, Goran Dragic had been in foul trouble. They started pushing the pace, Miami did, and got a couple of buckets. And that was also when they began putting the ball in Johnson's hand, and he started lighting up Morris and Tobias Harris, and that was kind of the period in which the Heat were able to get out to, really a 5-8-point lead throughout the end of the game, and Detroit never particularly challenged at that point.
Did the way that the Heat kind of struggled, or not the way the Heat struggled, the way the Pistons struggled with some of their defensive matchups give you any pause in terms of them now that we know they're going to face Cleveland in the first round?
Well, it was kind of tough for Detroit without Reggie Jackson. He's not great on defense from an effort standpoint, but he's also better than Steve Blake. He just at least has the physical capability to compete. Blake really struggled with Goran Dragic when Dragic was in the game. Dragic had 16 points in only 26 minutes, and at one point he had 16 points in 18 minutes. You know, of course, they'd never give it to him down the stretch because, you know, whatever reason. It's the Wade and Johnson show. Down the stretch, it's a little weird that Wade will always pass it to Johnson and, you know, never gave Dragic a chance to run things, you know, before Johnson got there down the stretch. But that's neither here nor there. I thought that was a problem. I mean, thought Detroit's inability to score was really kind of the bigger problem. I mean, outside of the 18 offensive rebounds that they got, they don't have anybody on this team who can run a pick and roll effectively other than Reggie Jackson. And they really, really missed him with Steve Blake having to play 32 minutes. And then Spencer Dinwiddie came in after that. And he and Stanley Johnson both were like pretty severely in the negative for their bench.
Another dynamic in terms of these teams, as they're both going to be playoff teams, is that in the first half, Amari Stoudemire was the backup center, and then they decided that didn't work, and then they were tried Udonis Haslem in the second half.
Yeah, Amari, he wasn't that terrible. You know, he was neutral in plus minus, played 6 minutes. I think that what happened was Whiteside had to go out of the game. I think he must have gotten his fourth foul in the third quarter, or just, you know, Spo was mad at him. And then at that point, Drummond was still in, and they didn't want to put Amari in against Drummond because they thought he was just going to get destroyed on the board. So they went with Haslem. Haslem was not particularly effective. I mean, he's about done, although, you know, they actually did pretty well when he was on the floor. It wasn't really particularly due to his efforts, and then he ended up going up against Baines. This is another thing that kind of rankled me a little bit. Aaron Baines was in the fourth quarter. You know, Baines played 15 minutes, and Drummond played 33. But in the fourth quarter, you've talked about this before, how with the possible intentional fouling, you want to have Drummond in at the starter quarters. And, you know, Stan Van Gundy had kind of been hanging around. They had not been doing well in that stretch. That was the stretch that Stanley Johnson and Dinwiddie were kind of racking up that negative plus minus. And then Aaron Baines took a jump shot with 10 on the shot clock wide open from maybe like 18 feet. And Stan Van Gundy immediately signaled for Andre Drummond to come back in the game. And that's the kind of recency bias that kind of bothers me with coaches. Like, so Aaron Baines was the best choice to be trying to win the game until he took that jump shot. And now Andre Drummond is because of that shot. You know, if you thought Aaron Baines was better, taking that shot is no, like, that didn't change anything about the situation going forward to where now Andre Drummond is a better matchup. Drummond is better than Baines. When as soon as he's ready to come back in, he should come back in. It's not like Baines taking that shot suddenly made Andre Drummond be more rested than he had been 15 seconds earlier. So, like, that's the kind of stuff with coaches that I think just does not make much sense. You know, and taking guys out of the game for a shot, especially if it was wide open, they weren't scoring. I didn't even think it was really that terrible of a shot. So, you know, I really just didn't understand that. And that's the type of behavior from coaches that kind of gets to me where, you know, you what happens on one possession in a game, I mean, unless it's just like continued mental mistakes, that to me does not outweigh, okay, who are these guys matched up against? Who do we think is the better matchup coming into the game? You know, who is a better player overall? All that stuff to me is more important than that kind of thing. It's a long soliloquy on that, but it's the type of thing that happens all the time. You know, and another one was, of course, that Greg Popovich subbing out Kawhi Leonard for 7 minutes of a game seven because he gave up a backdoor. You know, that's the other kind of similar example of that.
Yeah, and both of those examples are late in the season where those lessons have already been learned with veteran players. And the one note that I will do is that was not the first, let's call it, ambitious play that Aaron Baines tried in this game.
Yeah, there was one amazing play where he tried to spin baseline on Haslem and then throw a pass through about three guys that just got intercepted by Gerald Green along the baseline, like trying to do like a slick kind of hammer action type of pass to the opposite corner. And you could just hear, you know, someone on the Heat, I think it was probably Haslem, just yelling, "No way, no way, not going to work." And then he throws it and they just intercepted it. It was hilarious.
Awesome. Anything else you want to talk about with this game?
Yeah, I thought generally two larger themes here, and they're interrelated. One is that the old dudes from Miami, Wade, Dragic even with his craft, Joe Johnson, they were able to just kind of kill these younger guys on Detroit and teach them a lesson. Dinwiddie, you know, had a couple of bad fouls on pump fakes. He fouled even Udonis Haslem with 1 second left on the shot clock on a fadeaway jumper that had no chance. Stanley Johnson got in the air and fouled, I think, at least once. Dinwiddie had another where he got in the air. Those young guys struggled a little bit with the Heat guys at mid-range. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting was Miami, and this is partially, I think, because they have these old guys with this craft, they won this game from mid-range. Detroit was not able to get mid-range buckets. They don't really have anybody. And you know, generally, that's how you should set up your team, right? Mid-range shots are pretty inefficient. But if the other team is really focused on taking away the three-pointer and taking away the rim, and you've got Whiteside there at the rim, then, you know, you kind of have to have what you always call a countermeasure. And Detroit doesn't really have that. They don't have anyone who's really that good in mid-range. Maybe someone like Marcus Morris can kind of post up, but they don't have anyone who can attack off the dribble, really, and get into the mid-range, especially without Reggie Jackson. But even he is not great at that. He's got like an okay floater at times. So Miami was able to really stymie Detroit by taking away threes and the area right at the rim. And then on the other side, Miami has a ton of guys who are good in mid-range, and using that craft, that's where they were able to win the game. So at least for this one game, and especially with these personnel, mid-range really was able to beat the three and rim kind of Morey ball approach.
The other thing that I thought of it while you were talking was, I thought in this game about how Josh Richardson, you know, he didn't have a necessarily great box score game, but I thought he did a really nice job. And one of the big storylines for this Heat team that has survived Chris Bosh missing this time due to blood clots, regrettably again, is that they've gotten such nice contributions from guys they basically picked up off the scrap heap.
Yeah, Richardson was a second-round pick, and they signed him to the most favorable contract possible, as Albert Nahmad always likes to say, 3 years at the minimum, and then he'll still be a restricted free agent after that. Last 2 years, non-guaranteed. Played 37 minutes with Justice Winslow unavailable, and now that he's hitting his three-pointers, he even had like a couple of okay drives on closeouts, played great defense. You know, he's definitely a problem for kind of slower guys like Steve Blake. He had two blocks and a steal in this one. And, you know, he only took three shots in that 37 minutes, but he's enough of a threat the way he's been shooting the three that you have to guard him. And like the 40th pick in the draft is playing 37 minutes in a game that they won on the road against another playoff opponent. Like, that's just an unbelievable find for this Heat team.
And Tyler Johnson, before he got hurt, was probably an even better example. And we'll see if they can do the same with Briante Weber, who they just signed.
Yeah, and Jarrell Wright is, in fact, finally joining them now. Tyler Johnson, the news on him is not great. Like, he has not been able to really get back from that shoulder. There is some hope that he could come back at the start of this month, and it really just keeps flaring up on him, apparently. So he's not going to be back anytime soon, and you know, they almost really don't need him. You know, they don't have a backup point guard right now, but that's Tyler Johnson is not that either. Wade just plays as the backup point guard whenever Dragic is out of the game, and Dragic was in foul trouble throughout a lot of this one, and that was part of why Richardson played so much as well. But, you know, I think Richardson is probably even better than what Tyler Johnson was giving them, and Tyler Johnson was giving them something pretty good, too.
Yeah.
So now that I have retired from the law, I have become a small business owner, and I am very glad to have, as a support for that, Vistaprint.com. Vistaprint can offer you, as a starter, 500 business cards for a mere $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. CAPSPACE is very easy to remember. We use it as a promo code for all of our sponsors. And, you know, you just, if you have a side business, you can't use your work email. That's not going to work. You need to get another one. And now you're going to need a business card to let people know where to find you, and basically that your side business is serious, or even that your small business is serious. And not only do they do business cards, you can do postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, coffee mugs, whatever you want. You can put your logo on it. You can put whatever print you want on it. Vistaprint basically is your local coffee shop, but they're way cheaper because they have huge economy scale that your local coffee shop just doesn't have. You can customize text, colors, backsides on your business cards. They have thousands of industry-specific templates if you want to use that. And they can even help you design your card and your logo if you decide to go that route. So that 500 business cards starting at just $90.99 is a screaming deal, an example of what you can get at Vistaprint. Use that CAPSPACE code at checkout. Let them know that you came from us. They're a new sponsor, and we would love for them to stick around. So use that CAPSPACE code at Vistaprint today. All right, should we get to some playoff scenarios now?
Yeah, let's do it. So the best way for the East to explain it is, so the top seeds, the playoff matchups are done. So it's the Cavs, the Pistons, and then the Raptors against the Pacers. Those are done. So all that's left is the 3-6. And where I want to start with that is actually with Atlanta, in the way that Atlanta is guaranteed that they're going to be on the top. They're going to be hosting the series, but they're the overwhelming favorites actually to get the 4. Because in order for them to move up, they need to win and Miami needs to lose against Boston. So really, that's kind of where Atlanta is. And then Charlotte is on...
So let's stop there. Right. Are they the overwhelming favorites? I mean, Atlanta plays at Washington, who you would think is not going to be playing John Wall. Although Washington doesn't have any incentive to lose because Phoenix has their pick. So that's one aspect of it. But I still think the Hawks are pretty big favorites to win there. And the Heat on the second end of a back-to-back against a Boston team that I think is going to be trying to win, they are slight underdogs there. So I think
it's
when you combine those two, it's probably about a 50-50 proposition, at least in my mind.
Yeah, and so that's definitely an interesting...
Oh, you gave in so quickly.
Well, I mean, it's I think that I personally feel...
Is there something you don't see about that? You think that they're, like, those probabilities aren't necessarily right?
Yeah, I think Atlanta's going to care enough to win that game because the benefit of getting the 3 for them, specifically with Cleveland being out of the picture, is enough. And these games are all occurring at the same time, so I think they'll care. And... The other kind of team that I would say is the analog in a way on the bottom side is Charlotte, and that's Charlotte cannot get above the 5. And really for them, they're going to get the 6th seed unless they win and Miami beats Boston, because then they can jump Boston in. And then there is this one other really crazy hypothetical, which is the one that's kind of messing with people now, which is theoretically if Atlanta wins, so they move up and Boston beats Miami, and then Charlotte beats Orlando, then Miami actually falls all the way to the 6. And so then you get Atlanta-Miami in the 3-6 game.
Kind of similar to what happened to the Spurs last year.
Correct.
Where they were 2 going in, and then they losing at New Orleans. Everyone else won. They got dumped down to being the 6 seed, and that, of course, ended up being somewhat fatal to them. I think if I'm the Hornets, who do you want to play? Do you want to play the Heat? I think they have plenty of confidence against Boston. I think that the Hawks are probably the hardest matchup for them. I think they actually match up okay against the Heat with their shooting and the ability to really space out Whiteside a little bit. And I think they're also excellent at packing the paint. They're excellent at helping off of guys who can't shoot. We saw how well they did that against Boston yesterday. I actually like that matchup against the Heat okay for the Hornets. So I think I would be just resting guys, especially Nick Batum is questionable for tomorrow. So is Cody Zeller. I don't think that it really makes much of a difference. And then you also have the advantage of being opposite bracket of Cleveland too. If you're the 6, you're not going to have home court advantage either way. I'm just resting my guys if I'm Charlotte, but they're also playing against Orlando. That's kind of a tough game to lose almost.
Yeah. And Orlando they're settled into their picks. They could kind of go either way with whatever they're going to do. But the possibility for me that would make me push for Charlotte is that if they win and the Hawks win, which I think will happen, then all they need is Boston beating Miami, and then they get the team they want, I think, the most, which is the Celtics. Like, for me, Miami and Atlanta are kind of a coin flip for them. You can make an argument either way. I think there's some personal preference there, but I think Boston would be much more desirable for them. So I think you don't gun it, but I think you try to win just to maintain that possibility.
Yeah, I think I would tank it if I were them. I don't know that I would even necessarily rather play the Celtics. Or, I guess I probably would rather play the Celtics over the Heat. I mean, when you just beat a team on the road, just blew them out like that, you got
to
have some.
And I don't think they need to care about Cleveland at this point. I think that's too speculative for them at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, that's like the tiebreaker. But I think a lot of we're probably maybe even thinking about this more than they are. You know, I think that's like, at least from the coaching standpoint, you know, these guys want to, they're competitors. They go out and win every game, and maybe, you know, they might not play Batum and Zeller. I think it would be foolish not to play those guys at this point. Batum, as we noted yesterday, it wasn't that bad of an ankle sprain if he's at least considered questionable for tomorrow. So I don't know. I think I would for sure sit those guys and, you know, kind of come what may in the game. Boston, so they can be 4, they cannot be 3, they can be 4 if they win, And the Hawks also win, is that right?
That is correct.
Why do the Hawks have to win for them to be four?
Because that avoids the tiebreaker, because if the Hawks and...
Oh, the three-way tiebreaker?
Right, because then Miami wins the division, and then I believe that pushes Boston to the five, if that three-way happens.
Yeah, they would all be tied at 48 wins in that case. So yeah, the Hawks actually winning would be better for them. All right, I get that. I think we covered that pretty much. Why don't we get to the West now?
So the West, we'll start at the very bottom because I think that's the easiest to understand, which is that if Houston wins, they're in, and Utah needs Houston to lose and to beat the Lakers themselves.
Yeah, and Utah could very easily lose to the Lakers, I think. Rudy Gobert did not make the trip. And we'll get back to Sacramento in a second, since they're playing Houston. What's going on at the higher up in the bracket?
So higher up, Portland has control of their own destiny pretty clearly. If they win, they lock in at the number five. And if they lose, then they open the door, and then it really depends on Dallas. So if Dallas wins, then they jump into the five spot. And for Memphis, the way that they can get out of the seven is by winning.
And Portland plays at home against Denver. They win that game, as you said. They get the five. Dallas basically cannot get lower than six, whether they win or lose, because they still win the tiebreaker with Memphis. Dallas plays at home against San Antonio. Tony Parker and Kawhi Leonard will not be traveling there. Dallas certainly would like to win that game and hope that Portland loses. And Portland will know whether Dallas has won or not, I think, pretty close to the time that they tip off. Memphis, we're assuming that they lose to the Warriors. Obviously, if that doesn't happen, it would be pretty big news in a number of ways, but one of them might be that Memphis could get higher. I don't think that's obviously going to happen. They, had a pretty desultory effort against the Clippers tonight. I don't expect a ton different on the back end of a back-to-back in Golden, what should be a pretty motivated Golden State team. And then, as you mentioned, Sacramento at Houston. Houston must win that. Well, doesn't have to, because they could still get in if Utah loses. But Sacramento is going to have basically the same cast. They have DeMarcus is going to be out. Collison is going to be out. Rondo is going to be out. Caspi is going to be out. Bellinelli is going to be out. And they also have, segueing into the lottery now, quite the incentive to lose.
Yeah, they do, because they're actually, a lot of the lottery is settled, but there's this big mass that is at 8, 9, and 10. Because the Knicks clinched the 7 spot, though they're not keeping their own pick. And so 8, 9, and 10 is Sacramento, Denver, and Milwaukee. They all have exactly 33 wins.
Yeah, and 48 losses as well. We finally have caught up with the same number of games played for all of them. Sacramento, they can be 8 through 10, basically. They owe that top 10 protected pick to the Bulls if it falls out of the top 10. So if they finish either 9 or 8... they're pretty much safe. It's like below a 1% chance that two teams could jump them. What happens if they finish at 10?
So if they're at 10, what they need to have happen is that they don't jump into the top three, of course, and that one of the teams 11 through 14 jumps them. There's about a 9% chance that that could happen. So it's certainly possible, but it's not particularly likely. And it is impossible for them to get to 11 because Orlando already has 35 wins.
That's right. And then the way the tiebreaker would work for the lottery is it's basically just a series of coin flips, either a coin flip or a series of coin flips if it's a three-way tie, that breaks that tie to determine what the default order is. But all those teams still have the same number of combinations in the lottery to move up to the top three if they, in fact, are tied. With Milwaukee, they're playing Indiana at home. That will be a meaningless game for the Pacers. Milwaukee could well win that. Denver playing at Portland, I think they will probably try and win it, especially because they have this pick swap with the Knicks that's already... And the Knicks are locked into 7. So Denver, they're probably not going to tank. They would think it would probably be fun to play spoiler for Portland. You think they're going to try, and Sacramento is not really going to be trying at all. So my prediction is that Milwaukee and Denver are both going to win. And
you think Denver is going to beat Portland?
I'm sorry. No. That's it. Thank you. That was completely wrong. I do not think that.
That would have been a bold prediction.
Thank you. Thank you. Denver's been frisky, but...
And Portland lost at home to Minnesota.
Yeah, they did. I think that game could be close. It's either... but it kind of reminds you, too, of last year when Utah was playing and had been really frisky and played in Houston and just got completely destroyed by like 30. You know, guys could kind of be looking forward to their vacation in that last game of the season too. So yeah, I think Sacramento and Denver probably tie, and then Milwaukee will be 10. And then even if Milwaukee wins, they'll still all be tied. So there's only a 33% chance of Sacramento falling to 10 and then having a 10% chance of losing their pick. So it's pretty darn hard for them to lose their pick is what we're saying.
You know that what we're going to see is Sacramento beats Houston and then the Jazz lose to the Lakers behind Kobe Bryant's 45 points.
I'll be interested to see that one. There is that consideration, too, for Utah. I mean, that's the next place we should go. Chicago, Washington, and Utah kind of locked into things. Chicago has 41 wins. Washington owing their pick to the Suns, but probably not going to be trying. They're probably going to lose to Atlanta. And then Utah, Rudy Gobert did not make the trip, as we mentioned. They may know that it's hopeless. They'll have known whether Houston won already when the Lakers game starts, so they could kind of shut everyone down. Derek Favors has been hurt, too. So if they don't have Favors or Gobert, and who knows how hard they're going to try in that one, then that's probably becomes about a 50-50 proposition, and it would be in Utah's best interest to lose that one and rather than potentially being tied with Chicago. Chicago plays Philly at home. Or maybe they would actually want to stay tied with Washington that's going to lose. Chicago plays Philly at home. They're probably going to win that to get to 42 wins and be the number 14 pick.
And the Lakers are 5 games clear on either side, so they can try as hard as they want.
Yeah, the only other one that's interesting, Brooklyn is the 3 seed. Phoenix is the 4 seed. Brooklyn is a game, quote-unquote, behind Phoenix. They have 21 wins. Phoenix has 22. Phoenix plays the Clippers at home. The Clippers, I'm sure, will not be trying it in that one. Brooklyn plays Toronto at home. Toronto, we haven't heard anything about whether they're going to be trying either. If I'm Toronto, I would actually try and lose that game just to push the Celtics, who have Brooklyn's pick, back. Why do you want a team in your division that's a threat to you to get a better pick? It's kind of long-term thinking, but I certainly wouldn't be trying it in that one. I mean, I'm not saying they're going to tank it on the court, but I think you definitely, if you had any questions about resting anyone, that could kind of push you in that direction.
Just play. Start Bruno Caboclo. Play him all 48.
Yeah, what would be the, I guess, Biombo shooting threes would be like the equivalent.
Noguera
of like
shooting threes.
Edson. Oh, no. Noguera's a way better shooter.
I know,
than
but Biombo, you can't, that people would just like start a petition or something.
Why? Your team won 55 games already.
Bebe's an enthusiastic Brazilian guy. I think you could probably sell it a little bit. Like, he and Caboclo just like get in a 3-point shooting contest that runs the entire last 3 quarters.
The other interesting thing that happened today was Toronto, by winning against Philadelphia at home, which was always going to happen, clinched having one of the clinched the 5th best record. And that's important because now that enables a pick swap in the second round between Brooklyn and the Clippers to happen. And that's actually going to be a pretty good Brooklyn pick. The reason that happened is from the Reggie Evans trade. It was actually a pick swap. And the pick swap was protected for the last 55 because of just a BS trade that the Clippers made with Cleveland. I forget who it was. But if the Clippers had finished in the top 5 records, then they would have had to send their pick to Cleveland. They would not have been able to swap that pick, therefore, with Brooklyn. But now they will have their pick. They can swap it with Brooklyn. And that will be, pretty good, like the 32nd or 33rd, 34th pick in the draft for this Clippers team.
And just how weird how long this thing can go is that Reggie Evans pick, I believe that was traded in 2012, is that right?
Yeah, Reggie Evans, and then he featured prominently by not being guarded in the Nets losing the following year to the Bulls in 2013.
And so the reason why that they had to have that carve out was because the pick with the Cleveland, the top 5 protected, that was from 2009, and it's still affecting this in 2016.
Was that part of the Kyrie Baron Davis trade?
No, it was Clipper. It was Clippers New Orleans in 2009. I honestly don't know what trade that was.
Oh, yeah. Now we're really getting into the weeds. Before we move on, a quick break to tell you about our friends at Helix Sleep, who have basically found a better way to buy a mattress. Going to the store to buy a mattress is pretty sorry, let's be honest, right? You get there, you're going to lay down, do you take your shoes off? Is that kind of weird? The salesman is standing right there. Are you going to lay there for what, 2 minutes? Maybe max before it gets awkward? 10 minutes? You're going to try and sleep? Are you going to wake up and feel how it feels? No, you're not. You're probably sleeping on top of some covers or something. It's really just a miserable experience. It's high-pressure sales tactics. Oh, and by the way, it costs thousands of dollars to get a mattress. Helix Sleep has a better way now. You go online, you fill out their 2 to 3 minute questionnaire, and they will create a mattress that is works just for you and your body type. If you have a significant other, they can even do a split mattress. And it's really comfortable. It gets shipped to you in 7 to 10 business days, and it costs between $600 and $1,000. And less than that, the URL actually is helixsleep.com/capspace, and you can get $50 off your first purchase. Even just check it out to get a little bit more information about it as well. It's just a totally superior way of buying mattresses. And if their first attempt at getting it right for you doesn't work, you can return it free. Go to helixsleep.com/capspace, helixsleep.com/capspace. From the past to the future, you and I both went to the Nike Hoop Summit practices for 3 days. We, of course, watched the game as well. You know, we missed kind of the two best days because we wanted to come back for that Spurs-Warriors game. But, you know, we got a good chance to check out some of the future talent. It was a little bit disappointing in past years. The World, actually, I think, had won 3 out of the last 4. And for those who don't know what the Hoop Summit is, it's basically the top U.S. players in the graduating high school class against whoever Nike can kind of come up with out of the World, the best players who are under 20, essentially. And that World team has been nasty in past years. You know, they've had Karl Towns, Dirk Nowitzki, Tony Parker, who's played in this game, Andrew Wiggins, you know, really, really awesome teams. Anthony Bennett, back when everyone thought he was going to be good, he was the number one pick, played in the game as well. But we didn't really see that level of talent from them this time, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the way it can happen sometimes. But the U.S. team, I thought they looked good. There wasn't anybody to me, and this was my first time covering the Hoop Summit, which was a very fun experience. But what struck out to me was there are a lot of guys that I liked and really liked, but nobody that I loved in that sense. And part of that was that we didn't get to see Josh Jackson. We only got to see him in when we watched the game because he came a little bit late.
Yeah, I saw Josh a little bit too in the U19 World Championships last year. Jackson, a little bit of he's a really athletic wing guy. Also, you know, plays really hard, competes really hard. He actually just came out of prep school and is
in Napa.
So he is he's 19, a year older than most guys in his class. He said he has no interest in doing the Thon Maker and declaring for the draft this year. We don't know whether that would succeed anyway with him being out of prep school. He says he's not ready for the NBA, so he's going to go to school. He's uncommitted, talking about
he committed to Kansas earlier this week.
Oh, did he? Okay, good. Actually, that's bad because I went to Arizona for law school. I'd rather he went to Arizona. But anyway, yeah, you know, I think his jumper is a little broken right now. Like, he can hit it off the dribble if he's kind of wide open, but he really brings it up. It's a very long shot. He kind of puts it in front of his body, then, like, rests it on his in front of his head. Pretty low release, not very fast, not very classic. That's something I think he's really going to have to rework if he's going to be, you know, a real potential superstar. But he's got nice handle, he can pass, and he plays really, really hard, and, you know, he's an absolute skywalker as well. So a guy certainly who, you know, I think has all the athleticism of a top five player, not quite sold on the shooting and ball skills, and especially given that he's a year older than a lot of these guys, to say, all right, this guy is a future superstar for sure. But there are so many guys on this team that played hard and were good and you know, just kind of impressed with their skill level in the practices. The game, I think, was almost so bad that just because of the lack of guards on the World team, that, you know, you couldn't really take that much away from it. But yeah, I think Jackson is probably considered by most to be the best prospect. Who do you think, other than Harry Giles, who didn't play, he's torn two ACLs, but he was kind of considered the number one player in this class before the year began and was great in the U19s. Who would you say of the remaining guys on the U.S. team has the highest pro ceiling?
Highest pro ceiling. I really, really like Jonathan Isaac. I think he could be one of those kind of new agey fours who could dance a little bit at the five. He has a nice little jump shot. His handle for a guy that size is pretty good. He plays with energy. I like him. The other guy that I really liked was Jason Tatum, who's smaller but has more of a guard skill set. I actually talked to him a little bit after one of the practices, and he said he prefers defending twos and threes, and I asked him about playing the four, which is what I feel his eventual NBA position will be. And he basically was open to it, but of course he's, you know, a high school kid. That's a big step for him. But I like both those guys a lot.
Isaac, 6'10", 205, 7'1", wingspan, 9 foot standing reach. So it has the size of a power forward, very skinny, obviously. Draft Express compared him to Quincy Miller, who I think actually has kind of a very similar feel. Isaac has good ball skills. He lit it up from three in the two practices that we saw on Wednesday. You know, not quite the shooter or kind of ball skill. I mean, every skinny guy who can shoot gets compared to Kevin Durant. You know, he's nowhere near that level as far as his shooting or his feel or anything like that. Didn't play all that well, actually, in the game itself. He was one of the few U.S. players who didn't. But yeah, he's certainly an intriguing prospect as a potential stretch four. You know, we didn't see a ton of him like trying to guard on the perimeter, get into a stance. So whether he can put on enough weight to really hold up at the power forward position, be a good rebounder. You know, I didn't see a ton of rebounding from him this week, but again, that's a pretty small sample. I mean, we're talking about, you know, two practices in a game, you know, so this is just very preliminary at this point. Tatum, kind of prototypical size for a wing, competes. Pretty strong body already, going to Duke, and likes to defend as well. I think that he is, you know, someone who, and his jump shot, a little wonky form, but looks smooth, not broken. He's got some mid-range game as well. Good athlete, not great athlete, but I think someone who could be a very solid 3-and-D type who could also, you know, attack a little bit off the dribble, maybe in pick and roll as he gets to learn the game a little bit more. But so, you know, certainly another guy, there's just a lot of solid prospects in this class. I would say, actually, the guy I would pick who might have the most upside would be Markelle Fultz.
The first time we saw him, he didn't pop to me, but then at that second practice, and then in the game, I was like, oh man, this guy has a lot of talent. He's a lot of what I liked about Dante Exum, in that he can defend both guard positions, and he can play on and off the ball, which is just such a great combination in this league, no matter where you end up in terms of role and niche.
Yeah, his shooting is not amazing, but no reason to think that it won't come around to where, you know, he can be an acceptable three-point shooter at the NBA level. He just has fantastic feel for getting into the lane, the most creative passer on either team by far at the guard position. You know, he threw like one just sweet bounce pass to a guy cutting along the baseline when he drove into the teeth of the world zone defense. That really impressed me. He had a couple of nice alley-oops. He's got a pretty solid floater game as well. Creativity, finishing. You know, he's not going to dunk on people, but, you know, he has some pretty good craft around the rim. And, you know, his handle is not that tight either. You know, the ball kind of sticks in his hand a little bit with each dribble. You know, he's got to kind of turn it over in his hand before he dribbles again. It's not just like popping out of his hand. And that matters because the faster you dribble, the faster you can adjust and the more time the ball kind of spends in your hand. And the more moves you can make to kind of fool people. So he's got to tighten his handle up a little bit, but just the natural feel and creativity for a guy who, you know, was on the junior varsity in his high school at DeMatha until, you know, his sophomore year, until his junior year. That's is pretty impressive. I think he has the most upside. Don't know if he gets there, but I thought he was pretty impressive.
Is it time to talk about Aiden?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, a couple of quick notes, though, on some of the U.S. guys. Jared Allen, kind of an old school fro, pretty skinny, not that athletic, but also has a 7'5 wingspan, some decent touch. He's going to kind of need to get a little bit better at banging, get a little more confidence, get stronger. He's a 6'10, 227. But a guy who has great timing with his shot blocks, especially with that wingspan, 9'3 standing reach. And then Marcus Bolden, who was 6'11, 250, 7'6 wingspan, 9'4 standing reach. So great, great measurements, pure center size, excellent touch with both hands around the rim as well. And when he catches it and can kind of take a step, he'll actually try and dunk on people too.
Yeah, nice aggression. I like that from him.
Did not really impress defensively. He really needs to get in better cardio shape. It is the biggest thing for him. Like, one drill that they did in practice was they basically just played 5-on-5 for 5 minutes without really any stoppages at all. And 3-4 times on the court, and he was just dragging. That happens for a lot of young big guys. You know, it's not to say that he can't improve it, but it's really the biggest thing that he needs to work on as well. But, you know, I really was impressed with his measurables, and his skill level gets fantastic extension on his jump hook as well. Can shoot jumpers out to 15 feet reliably, I think, also, you know, at least, you know, compared to a lot of big guys his age. So he's someone who has a ton of potential as well. But yeah, Ayton is the one who's actually a year younger than this class. He's Bohemian, and, you know, but also, and has a ton of potential. What do we think about that? I mean, were you like as blown away? Because everyone was like, oh yeah, this guy's the number one pick in 2018 for sure, you know, kind of going in.
So I'd seen him before because I actually saw Ayton and Josh Jackson play in a game at Prolific Prep in Napa, which was a great experience going into the Hoop Summit because I'd seen those two guys before who were two of the most hyped guys at the whole Hoop Summit. Ayton to me is like if you had a, you know, like if you, for those of you who played basketball video games and you're creating a player and like they give you a certain number of like basically ability points. And if you used all of those on like physical gifts and a couple of other extraneous abilities, he moves incredibly well for a guy his size. Not quite at the level of Willie Cauley-Stein, but maybe a step below that, which is pretty high praise for somebody especially his age. And when he cares and when he works at it, he's just a beast. And I've just been struck by how that doesn't happen as consistently as you want, but also he is super young and he can figure it out.
I see the potential of what everyone is talking about with him. You know, he has really center size, a body that I think can develop, and he's obviously skinny. He's 17 right now. He's going into his senior year in high school. Quick, athletic, all of that. He wasn't like quite a nuclear athlete that I expected, but pretty darn good. I mean, and certainly guys can get a lot more explosive as they get stronger going through high school. You know, Giannis Antetokounmpo is a guy like that who did that in about 4 months when he first got into a training program. But to me, it didn't strike me as like, all right, for sure, this guy is the next superstar, you know, with some of the other guys that you see even at that age. I think that, you know, he's not the most cerebral player. He struggled a little bit to kind of learn what some of the play calls were in the practices, you know, to kind of get drills right. He also kind of struggled with a back injury a little bit in the early part of the week. He can shoot the ball pretty well, but he has a low release. You know, I don't think he's going to be able to shoot a turnaround jumper unless he makes his release a lot higher in the post. And he also just doesn't really have any moves at all. When he gets a burr under his saddle, he'll get on the offensive glass, but that's not something that happens a ton. I don't think he's in bad shape, but he's not in amazing cardio shape either at this point. And you just don't hear great things about the people around him, the high school program that he's in, either that it's all kind of enabling. There's not really anyone who's challenging him, trying to kind of get him on the right path. I think that this week was probably good for him. And it might have been a little bit better if they had some other guys who could really challenge him in the practices because there weren't any other athletic big men really on the world roster. So I think he has the talent to get there, but I wasn't like so wowed by him that I'm like, oh yeah, this guy's the next superstar, number one pick for sure. He's got a long, long way to go to get to that point.
He reminds me in that way, maybe a little bit also thinking about Jonathan Abram's book, of a guy like Jermaine O'Neal, where the talent was always there and it was kind of undeniable in the sense of like, if he gets there, he's going to be really good, but it will take some time and it will take some development. And so that's a different challenge than when you're thinking about somebody like Karl Towns, or even in that case, kind of Joel Embiid, which of course he has the health issues, but the idea was that he would be able to contribute more even as he's getting better.
Yeah, Joel Embiid might be somewhat of a comp for him, frankly. You know, I think that's actually a decent one. They've kind of similar. Joel probably actually has even, you know, a little better measurables than DeAndre does, but and I think it was just a little bit stronger of a natural frame as well. All right, what do we have for news here before we go?
So I guess, do you want to start with the logos? I think that might be the place to start.
Yeah, Darren Revelle and Brian Windhorst co-authored a piece today saying that a vote is expected to occur and be approved very shortly for logos on jerseys starting in the 2017-18 season. Coincidentally, that is when a new CBA would kick in. Adam Silver has said that he likes it, not even so much because of the specific money that companies will pay to get the ad on the jersey, but also because he believes that those companies then will be more invested in the league and will, you know, spend more money kind of promoting the league. Also, there's a little kind of ancillary benefit in that there's a planned obsolescence to jerseys now, just like what you see in soccer. And it's not going to be nearly as obtrusive as what you see in soccer, even in European basketball. It's supposed to just be, you know, a couple inches by couple inches patch on the shoulder area of the jersey for these sponsors. And then 50%, the proposal is that 50% of that revenue will be shared, and then the other 50% will go to the team. So that'll also be a way for the big market teams to even kind of make more as well. you know, there's sort of been just a little bit of a backlash to this. You know, just there always has been that it's just too much commercialization of sport. I don't care. What do you think?
As long as they keep it small and reasonable, I'm totally good with it. But if it starts to become like the European soccer, where basically that's what's on the front of the jersey, I'm not super comfortable with that.
Yeah, I agree. I would like for it to kind of be something where it's not an essential part of the jersey, because I do think, you know, I love these uniforms and I don't want, you know, it to be so large that it takes away from that. But yeah, if it's small like that, you know, I don't really care. And frankly, like, let all these guys make more money. You know, that whatever the, like, slight aesthetic detriment to me might be is far less than just everyone getting to make more money that they actually get to spend. And yeah, you know, I can deal with, like, this thing that takes up, you know, 1% of my vision when I'm looking at a player. It's not the
deal. And nothing that facilitates more sleeve jerseys, because I'm just opposed to that. I'm more opposed to that than the logos across the whole thing.
Well, I feel the same way about the sleeve jerseys. Like, fans like to buy them. I mean, probably half the jerseys when you go to a Warriors game are sleeve, because, you know, basketball jerseys don't really look that good. Do you wear the t-shirt underneath? Do you not? You know, all that, like, it doesn't really work that well. So, well,
they should make sleeve versions of the normal jerseys. Just it doesn't have to be exactly what the players wear if the players don't want to wear them.
Yeah, but that's, I don't think, like, a t-shirt jersey that the players aren't actually wearing is just doesn't have the same appeal. You can't charge, you know, $200 for it the way you can if that's what the players are actually wearing. So I think it's fine. You know, the whole sleeve jerseys thing doesn't really bother me at all. If they want to make more money, let them make more money. It's just, you know, it's not that big a deal to me.
Where do you want to go from here?
A couple other minor things. The Suns have bought their D-League team, the Bakersfield Jam. They are moving that to Arizona. They're now the second team that has done that. Utah did as well. This is another investment that they are making. You know, again, the team probably is going to make less money when it's not, you know, so near to the actual NBA team and has to kind of compete with it in a sense. But the point of the D-League is to develop players and teams that are willing to make the financial commitment to make that the priority over the financials should be commended. And the Suns are the latest team to do that. It's just much easier to be able to send guys back and forth, have your executives easily go to one of the practices and observe it, have a meeting with the staff, send guys down even for just, you know, one game real quick, even just to practice, you know, if the main team isn't practicing. All of that is really very convenient. And, you know, I think you get almost, you know, you could probably almost double the worth of a D-League team to have it, like, that much more convenient.
As a former resident of that immediate area, or not then, of Arizona in general, is there a place close enough to Phoenix where they could put it where it wouldn't be maybe as direct competition?
It could be in Tucson, but then they have U of A. They're putting it in some city that I can't remember. That's why I just said Arizona. I think it's probably pretty close to Phoenix.
Yeah, I would assume it would be.
And the last thing, there was just an unbelievable media crush at Warriors practice today. I did not go. But Draymond also had a tweet that he said essentially he's going to pay for three kids, underprivileged kids, I guess, to go and watch this game. He said, you know, for them to go and see history. I guess they're pretty confident that they're going to win, because I don't think he wants them to go and see history of them losing to only tie the record. But, you know, interesting level of confidence there, and makes me think also about that game, that it just, if Memphis manages to somehow, you know, stay within 10, get close to tying it in the third quarter-ish, or Memphis gets up by 10 at any point, could be a really, really weird vibe. I mean, if you think about it, like, this game, granted they're playing a pretty easy team, but this is almost like more pressure than, you know, any game except an elimination game in the playoffs in some ways.
Yeah, there's a lot of strain on there. And as the son of an elementary school teacher, I will mention that I think all three kids have high grades. Like, I think that was a part of it as well. So anything that can encourage kids that, hey, if next year your team is really good, then that can help you get tickets to a game, I support it for that reason as well.
All right, that'll do it for today. Please check out our sponsors, Helix Sleep, at that helixsleep.com/capspace URL. Even just go check out the product, even if you're not ready to buy a mattress yet. And then also the Capspace code on Vistaprint is another great way. You can get those 500 business cards for only $9.99 with that offer. Those are both new sponsors. So if you support the podcast by buying something from them, that will make them continue on and help us keep this endeavor going. We're actually, if we can keep all these new sponsors on, we'll actually be breaking even. And since this is my primary job, that actually will be awesome.
Yeah.
So we appreciate the support. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I wanted to mention also that they can also listen to the same two people if they want. We recorded a Real GM Radio because today kind of is the anniversary of Dunked On. And so that will come out you know, a couple hours from when this is released, and so people want to listen to that as well.
Yeah, we talked a little bit. It was a fun conversation, just kind of talking about what the genesis of the podcast was, how we kind of put it together, and, you know, also we talked, you know, a fair amount of basketball for like 40 minutes, too. So if you want to skip past the part that's about our own vanity, you can do that and still get some good basketball conversation as well.
If you want.
All right, follow me on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA. As I said, we're going to be live tweeting the games pretty much through the playoffs. Danny is Danny LaRue. Also, with all the awards stuff that was out today, you can go back and listen. Last week, we did our own awards podcast. We have all of our picks in there. A little more context for that now with guys, some of the big luminaries, Zach Lowe, Pelton, all of them doing their awards picks that came out today. All right, that's enough plugging. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back tomorrow talking about how the playoff field got set. Till then.